Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, whatever happened to the Bitcoin boom? After the astonishing rise at the end of last year, Bitcoin sunk, bounced, and then sunk again. Have we lost interest? Is this still the future? And why aren't people searching for gold? Also today, from investing to saving, our Atom Bank riding to the rescue, and a car owner's being ripped off by some garages by changes to the MOT. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Now, it wasn't long ago that Bitcoin seemed to be all anyone was talking about. Cryptocurrencies, we were told, were the future. Bitcoin was the trailblazer. Just 6 months ago, trading at more than $19,000 it was. But fast forward to now, and it's down to around $7,500. A sign, perhaps, of its volatile nature, and it'll be back up there soon. Or have we had enough of Bitcoin and maybe cryptocurrencies in general? A very warm welcome to you both. Lee, firstly, what's Bitcoin? What's cryptocurrency?
So Bitcoin is a sort of original cryptocurrency. It was created in 2009. A digital currency that you can use to buy and sell things online if, you know, website accepts it. It only exists online. To get hold of Bitcoin, it must be mined by people that have computers that have the capabilities to do it. And they solve complex mathematical problems to get hold of the Bitcoin. Transactions are shared on a large public ledger called the blockchain to ensure that there's full sort of integrity in the system. And that goes with most cryptocurrencies. That's how they work. That's how they operate. There's loads out there. And at the moment, what we're seeing is there's been a real slowdown of interest in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general. You know, there was a sort of time last year, I would say, as we ran up to sort of Christmas, Everyone, from the man in the pub to the man in a taxi to every single person that you possibly could ever think about, your mum, your nan, anyone, was talking about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, how they were going to get involved in it, why it's the next best thing since sliced bread. But basically, no one really had a clue what it was.
Which is normally a sign that it's probably not a great investment if the person in the street and you know, your taxi driver and your hairdresser is recommending it. But what, before we get into the more details about that, what is so attractive about it, about the technology? People are talking about it being like the future of the way we transact. It cuts out banks. It's a bit liberating. Are these all the reasons
that's exactly the reasons for a lot of people, exactly what you said there, especially stripping out the banking aspect of it, because it gives people an opportunity to transact in a way that doesn't involve that middleman. But I would say actually the other half of people are just people that thought they can make a quick buck out of it, if I'm being quite honest, Georgie. And as you know, Simon always highlights on this show that you should be investing for the long term. Well, people weren't looking at buying Bitcoin really and holding it onto the long term. They were looking for quick term gains, and that's what's kind of happened. And there's a lot of people that have been winners out of this because they would have bought Bitcoin, you know, at the beginning or even sort of a year, two, 3 years ago, who have seen it go up 50-fold, you know, and have made absolutely huge profits about it. And there was a real spell again last year when all we kept on reading about was how so-and-so bought $5 worth of Bitcoin in, you know, 2011, have now got a 50 homes and have done this, that and the other with it, and they've cashed out, they've done great. It's that classic bubble thing where, right, as it was going up, people were getting involved and getting involved and getting involved. And it went up to $20,000 a coin almost just before Christmas, I think the 20th of December, from, you know, basically $1,000 a coin at the start of the year, from basically nothing the year before that. It just went up so quickly, and it just the
so
momentum
where you bought in as
exactly
to how. If you bought one for $100, you're doing all right, even at $7,500.
You've done absolutely fine, but there's going to be people that have bought in at that peak or bought in at $12,000 or $15,000 thinking there's only one way this is going up, and people probably now are still sitting on their Bitcoin hoping that it's going to go back to the levels that they bought in. And there's no guarantee that that's going to happen. So I've been looking at the prices, and actually in the last 3 months, it's has been a very volatile currency. It still is volatile. It very much is still volatile, but it's kind of within a price range of about $9,000 to about $7,000. It hasn't gone out of that zone in the last few months. So it's kind of stabilized.
Leveled out? Is that its
equilibrium? Who knows?
I mean,
it's really hard to tell because there's been all sorts of governments talking about cracking down on cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. We've seen a Google crackdown on, you know, amount of firms that can sort of advertise Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general. And of course, Bitcoin, it's like a lot of things in life. Bitcoin is the first and the original one, so that might not necessarily mean it's the best cryptocurrency in the way that other cryptocurrencies that have come out might have better technology behind it, might have more uses behind it. You know, if you're the first at something, it's not necessarily going to mean that you're going to hold up and be, you know, the top thing. So there's lots of other cryptocurrencies that have other benefits and have other things worth considering. So you've got currencies such as Ethereum, Ripple, for example, you know, being very, very popular, quite easy to get hold of. Get a wallet, you buy it from an exchange and you hold on to it. So I don't know if Bitcoin has had its day. I don't know if it's ever going to sort of, we're going to see that kind of level of absolute intrigue. I mean, looking at trends for search engine data, we're looking at, since its peak, 90% drop in people looking at it. So it's kind of like, I think people got excited about it for a couple of months, and now it's just sort of like, it's got a bit boring. It's going to be interesting to see actually what happens over the course of the rest of the year, and whether, my gut feeling is that another one of these cryptocurrencies is going to have a bit of a run. I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, something happens that makes Ethereum or Ripple or one of the other sort of competitors just go through the roof. But who knows? I mean, it's just impossible to predict.
Well, it is, and we will look at this, Simon, but because perhaps Bitcoin was the trailblazer, it's the one, the cryptocurrency that people know about, is it time to sort of differentiate the two and say, actually, cryptocurrency in itself may be the future, Bitcoin may not be?
Well, I guess if you look at Bitcoin, you need to look at maybe three different things. One, there's the short-term element. So we're talking about something that's happened since December and what happened last year. It was a classic mania. You saw the price absolutely rocket. If you look at the classic bubble chart, which, you know, includes the different stages of a bubble, Bitcoin maps out almost perfectly on it. The problem with a mania is that you can make money in a mania. You can make money in a bubble when prices are rocketing. You've just got to make sure that there's someone else to buy it off you at a higher price. This thing called greater fool theory. They're always, you know, if there's a greater fool than you, you can always sell it to someone else at a higher price. And what happens is that the market peaks when it runs out of fools, and you don't want to be the last fool who bought. Now, there are going to be a lot of people who fit into that, you know, last bunch of fools. And I'm not calling them foolish, but it's just the classification, who bought very near the top and are down at the moment.
They probably feel quite foolish at the moment,
yeah,
I imagine.
Now, if they are in it for a short-term trading opportunity, then they have missed out. Because what they've done is they've bought at a much higher price and it's now at a much lower price. And they can choose whether they're going to just cut their losses and move out of it now, or whether they're going to sit on it and wait to try and get their money back. Now, if you are trading, just sitting on it and waiting to try and get your money back is usually one of the strategies that ends up costing people quite a lot of money. Generally, the idea is you run your winners and you cut your losers. Then you need to look at the question of whether Bitcoin is the future. That fits into the whole long-term investment case, which is, again, slightly separate. So is Bitcoin going to be the future? Well, it could be. This technology means that it could be the future of currency. If it's the future of currency, there is only a limited amount of Bitcoin, then yes, that could be a good investment case for buying into something that essentially does nothing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't produce anything. It doesn't make any profits. It doesn't pay any dividends. It does nothing. You're just investing in a concept, and that concept is entirely driven by sentiment.
Like so, art or something.
Yeah,
or
like
gold.
Art or gold. Yeah, classic cars. And in fact, you don't even get the enjoyment of art or classic cars, you know, that you would get. So is it the future? Lots of people buying into it saying this is the future don't really understand what they're buying into. I mean, I don't completely and fully understand cryptocurrencies, if I'm going to be entirely honest. I do know that Bitcoin is one use of the blockchain in order to create a currency that is not controlled by any central government or central bank, which is one of the arguments for being pro it, but also that there are other cryptocurrencies built on other versions of the blockchain that actually might be better suited to being the future of money or the future of finance. Things like Ethereum, things like Ripple, for example. And then there's the, is it a good long-term investment question? Now, what would make Bitcoin a good long-term investment would be, one, if it is the future, but two, if it has established itself enough to be a long-term store of value, of which its chief rival would be gold. Gold basically is valuable because it is a long-term store of value. 2,000 years ago, gold was a store of value. 2,000 years later, gold as a store of value. Now, Bitcoin, by being the first big cryptocurrency, decentralized, all those other things that we just talked about, it might have managed to cement a place for itself as a long-term store of value. There is a limited amount of it. You can't mine more than a certain amount, and as it gets closer to that limit, it's going to get harder to mine. So maybe there is a long-term investment case there for holding on to it. What there definitely isn't is a long-term investment case for investing 75% of your wealth into something like that. It needs to be a small amount of money. And I guess the sensible thing to do would be to hold a small amount of it, and it's kind of like either a small bet or an insurance policy on the fact that Bitcoin does one day go to 100,000. And at the moment, you know, it's down near the bottom, fallen off that bubble thing. But that's not to say that actually if you zoomed out, this isn't just a little blip on a much bigger bubble chart and it does go to 100,000.
What does your gut tell you about this, Simon? You've asked all those questions. You've given a fair answer, but what does your gut tell you about cryptocurrencies?
What does my gut tell me about cryptocurrencies? That this story is not done yet. That there will be another, another step up and another boom. That it will go quiet for a while and then it will bubble up. Or it will just be derailed by something completely different that comes along and is better. My gut tells me that it was worth me putting a small amount of money into three different cryptocurrencies that I've held, and it's kind of an insurance policy of just in case this thing does go, just in case this thing is the future, then I'll make a little bit of money off it. And
would
I'm not talking about a sizable amount of money. Well,
when did you do that?
Earlier this year. So, and it's down about 200 quid. So on, you know, it's quite a bit actually, because it was only £1,000 in the first place. It's down 20%, but you know, I, as far as I'm concerned, I can let that money sit there, and you know, it's a small bet on this being right. And you know, there is this idea where you don't over commit yourself to those kind of things, but that it is worth taking small bets on very long odd chances, because actually sometimes those pay off.
To be a bit niche, you don't have to, in terms of investing, you don't actually have to invest in the currency directly, do you? You can invest in trusts that invest in the technology, is that right? There are other ways in.
Yeah, you can do. You could invest into the crypto industry. The difficulty with that is trying to spot what is valuable within the crypto industry. What's going to profit from cryptocurrency and what's not going to profit. So you could buy, you can even buy into funds that invest in a number of cryptocurrencies. And apparently, a lot more of the big investment firms are, now the dust has settled, looking at offering some kind of crypto offering to people. So it's here to stay. Mm. The difficulty with investing in companies that do crypto stuff is there's a long history of new technologies that turn out to be very successful, but the companies that are involved with them don't do very well at all. This is a completely different scenario because it's manufacturing. Solar panels is a great example. Solar panels are absolutely brilliant and have come on in leaps and bounds, generate far more electricity than they did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever. If you'd have invested in solar panel manufacturers, you'd lost a lot of money.
Liam, I'm going to ask the same question to you. What does your gut tell you on this one?
Well, I think my gut tells me in this that cryptocurrencies are here to stick around. I think the reason that Bitcoin has kind of had that race, you know, to the top peak there, and is still sitting at actually quite a large sum of money per coin, is the limited supply of Bitcoin. You know, they put
no bones about it.
$7,500. Yeah, compared to this time last year, is absolutely still phenomenal return for people. It's the people that have been burnt in the aftermath of that. So it's still, you know, compared to other cryptocurrencies, it is way ahead in terms of value. And the reason for that is the limited supply of the number that can be mined. Now, the amount that have been mined is almost at capacity. They've almost been exhausted. Anything that's in limited supply like that has the potential to hold its value. But what my gut tells me is that Bitcoin isn't really that useful compared to a couple of the other cryptocurrencies that are more nimble, new generation, have come out in the aftermath of Bitcoin and are probably more likely to be of value in the future.
What do you mean more nimble?
They're just like the way that they've been created in the aftermath of Bitcoin, as in Bitcoin is the original. We've seen how Bitcoin's works and how it can be used and how it works. And then you've had other people, other developers that have come out, created cryptocurrencies that are just a bit different.
Refined, to some of these
exactly. So
glitches, maybe?
Exactly. So you've got that kind of thing. And also, let's not forget, actually, in the beginnings of cryptocurrency, and even up until not that long ago, there was a lot of fly-by-night firms where coins disappeared, people just lost their coins overnight. It's become a little bit more stable in the way that you can buy and sell Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general. What my gut tells me is that one of the other cryptocurrencies, one of the sort of five or six main ones, is going to go and fly. I don't know if anything's ever going to go at the same level as Bitcoin did because of the limited number of Bitcoin. That's what makes me think that's what drove the price up. A lot of the other cryptocurrencies have a much larger cap or have no cap at all. So, yeah, that's what my gut says, Georgie.
We shall see, eh? We shall see. Simon?
I think there's one important final point to be made on Bitcoin at the moment. You need to think about what moves prices, and a large amount of it is held by a very, very small number of people. Now, those people have been holding on to Bitcoin for quite a long time and don't seem to be showing any particular indication to be selling large amounts of it. They might do if they see it go up to a certain point. They might go, right, I'll make some money here. But they seem to be happy to just hold on to it on the basis that they're going to keep their wealth in Bitcoin. So what moved the price of Bitcoin up so much last year was the classic mate told a mate kind of thing, man down the pub. And it's the word of mouth thing. It spread, and you just had this wave of the general public just buying in and buying in and buying in. That's what moved the price up so much. The price then fell by a huge amount. Some of those people have sold out. Some of them have decided, no, Bitcoin's the future. I'm going to hold on to this, or I'm going to hold on to it until I make some money. But the people moving Bitcoin at the moment, and this is why it's so important that the searches have gone down so much. You can see the general public has just completely moved out of this. Mm-hmm. There's not so much going on. So you've either got people just nibbling around the edges who were already into it, or you've now got people trading it. Now, what was really interesting about the Bitcoin thing last year was it almost completely bypassed the trading and investment guys out there, because they were just looking at this going, this is completely nuts. And it moved up so fast and so quickly that it caught a lot of people out, because if you're looking at it from a traditional investment or even trading perspective, it was just going bananas. You couldn't get a grip on it. Now, however, it's calmed down and you've got people trading it. And so you need to understand that people are using like traditional trading matters. I'm reading something here on Ethereum World News. Bitcoin is consolidating inside an ascending triangle pattern as it formed higher lows and found resistance around 7,700. Price was rejected at the resistance again and looks ready for a test of support around 7,600. A bounce off this area could take Bitcoin back up to the resistance or even a break higher. A move below support, however, could lead to a downtrend of the same height as the chart pattern. The 100-day simple moving average is above the longer-term 200-day simple moving average to indicate that the path of least resistance is to the upside. This suggests that support is more likely to hold than to break. However, the gap between the moving averages has narrowed enough to signal a potential bearish crossover. For now, the moving averages might hold as dynamic support since they are close to the triangle bottom. Now, that might sound like absolute gobbledygook to you. However, if you are thinking of buying into Bitcoin now, I would... And that does sound like gobbledygook to you, and you are thinking, what on earth does that mean? I would advise you to learn a bit about that stuff and understand what it means, because it doesn't necessarily mean it's right, but you know what the people who are currently moving the price of Bitcoin are thinking and what they are using. They are using old-fashioned trading tools, charting, moving averages, and things like that, and they're using that to work out where they buy in and where they sell out, and they're trading the price. And you need to get your head inside that stuff, because that's what's moving the price at the moment. Unless you are, of course, just going to buy it and hold it for the next 5 years.
If anything is going to turn you off investing in cryptocurrencies, just take that recording of Simon there and play it to yourself and go, what, Lee?
If you are interested, though, we have got a comprehensive guide on how to buy and how to sell cryptocurrency.
He's on message, isn't he, Simon?
And it's thisismoney.co.uk/crypto.
Very good. Simon, you did actually talk about gold, but actually the investors aren't ploughing into gold, it seems, at the moment. Number of people interested in buying it appears to have dwindled to an 11-year low. This is according to more data from Google Trends. So I thought gold was a place where you put, you know, your money when economic times were tough. So does this tell us anything about economic times at the moment, or is it just something else going on?
Well, stock markets are knocking around record highs, so everything's been going up. People aren't really that fearful. We've had spikes in volatility. We had a spike in volatility earlier this year where people got a bit worried, had a bit of a sell-off. We had that little panic last week around the Italian stuff. But it didn't really dent market confidence much. People sort of just shrugged it off. So a combination of that and people just not being interested in buying gold indicates that everybody's quite confident. Now, whether you think that means that everybody is over complacent and that we are heading for a fall, and whether it might be a good time to buy that insurance policy that gold represents when other people don't want to, is another matter. Certainly, it's better to be buying gold when people aren't searching for it and when the price is depressed than to be buying gold when everybody is searching for it and the price is rising by, you know, 10% a month or something like that. And we did see a number of years back, it's going back quite some time now, we did see an astonishing rise in the price of gold. Nowhere near Bitcoin, nowhere near that mad, but yeah.
What are the pros and cons? I mean, it looks pretty. No question about it.
In all honesty, though, if you do buy gold, you don't really get to look at it. You could go get some sovereigns, or if you're really flush, you could get yourself some bullion, get yourself your own bar of gold.
Nice.
The problem with owning physical gold and taking ownership of it is that you then need to store it somewhere. And if you're going to store it in your home, you need to make sure that you're properly insured. And your home is not the best place to be storing gold. So if you're going to be storing it in a vault somewhere, you could go look at it. And it is possible with some of these companies to go look at your gold, but it's unlikely that you will. In most cases, you'll simply buy into some gold and it'll be a transaction on a computer screen and you'll never see the gold. But it's a long-term store of value that dates back thousands of years. Some people are big fans. Warren Buffett says it doesn't really do anything and there's no point holding it. You'd be better off buying a company
that makes profits
and pays dividends.
But I suppose a lot of the things that you invest in, you have no direct interaction with. So, you know.
No, very true. Very, very true indeed. I mean, very true indeed.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, from investing to saving, it's not news to savers that rates are disappointingly low, and they have been for quite some time. But could things be looking up thanks to a resurgence in fixed-rate bonds? Now, Atom Bank this week launched a new one-year deal paying 2.05%. Okay, but it is the first to pay more than 2% since April 2016. So, Lee, it may not sound like great guns, but it's certainly something, isn't it? So just give us a few more details about Atom Bank's offering and anyone that's not massively familiar with Atom Bank.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the barometer of these fixed-rate savings deals is that when a one-year deal ticks over 2%, actually, it's pretty good news for savers, really. It still doesn't beat inflation, but, I mean, it's still a step in the right direction for fixed-rate savings accounts. When you compare it to Easy Access, the Best Buy Easy Access rate is 1.31%. Quite a big gap between that and a one-year fix. So if you've got the capabilities of being able to put money away for a year and not touch it, this account might be a worthwhile one for you. So Atom Bank is a relatively new bank. It's online only, it's app only, so you can only actually open this account with its app, right? So that's going to immediately put some people off. Some people are not going to be comfortable. So for that reason, it's offering a slightly higher rate, you know, to entice people in, because it's already, you know, I swear the customers wouldn't use it. We actually criticised Atom Bank, if you cast your mind back, probably about 18 months ago. It launched a couple of really good Best Buy deals that blew everything else out of the water. And they pulled them relatively quickly.
Yeah, like about 2 weeks or something.
And, you know, there was criticism from customers that were struggling. You know, systems struggled to cope with the amount of people that tried to put money in, which actually shows you just how popular short-term fixed-rate accounts can be. So there's little things like that to consider. It's still FSCS protected, so your money's protected up to £85,000. And actually, if you compare it to the other fixed-rate deals that are on offer, it, again, looks quite attractive. So the best two-year rate also comes from Atom Bank, 2.15%, so it's only 0.1% more than what you'd get over a year. And the Best Buy three-year rate actually was launched today by Gatehouse Bank, which is 2.33%. So they're all things worth considering if you're looking for a fixed-rate account. Now, Atom Bank has had some teething problems. Actually, I just had a look at some of the reviews that it's had for its app on Google Play Store, and it doesn't make for pretty reading, actually. Yeah. So it's obviously had some teething problems.
Banks and tech?
Well,
oh,
there we go.
Me.
But the thing is, Atom Bank are, in a nutshell, Atom Bank are able to offer a Best Buy rate compared to, you know, big banks could if they really, really, really wanted to. But you've got to remember, Atom Bank started from scratch. So they don't have an expensive branch network. They don't have clunky old IT systems, which we've seen in recent weeks, what that can mean for a bank. So that's how it can offer these deals. And to be honest with you, I mean, it might stimulate a little bit more competition again in the fixed rate Wanderino. And it would be, you know, good news for savers if we can start seeing somebody. It's all been driven by challenger banks in recent years, you know, any good savings rate, any best buy rate. And what happens is they want to be top of the table for these sort of short-term fixes because they're quite attractive to savers who want them to just sort of bide their time until something better hopefully comes along, which I feel like we've been saying for many years. But again, yeah, if you're happy to give it a whirl on an app-only bank, this is the deal for you.
You know, it's great news that it's ticking up. Do you think this is part of a general trend, or is it only really dependent on whether other challenger banks get involved in this? Is this something that green shoots that we're talking about?
If you were going back to gut instincts, I'm going to probably say no. And the reason I'm going to say no is this. Atta Bank, top of the table at 2.05% of this one-year deal. And then below it, you've got the Gatehouse deal, which is also 2%. And then there's quite a big gap between that and the next Best Buy. I think it's about 1.86% below that. So that's quite a big gap. It would require a couple of more challenger banks to sort of leapfrog and get to the top of the table in order for more and more accounts to start bumping up the rates. So,
do you think we just have to get used to that? This is where we're at, really. Until we start ones and twos, and
until we start seeing interest rates, you know, start pumping up, and you know, funding for lending. Although the taps have sort of been turned off on that, it's still going to have quite a long sting in the tail for people. In the fact that mortgage rates are still, you know, in all intents and purposes, pretty much rock still at historic lows. So there's quite a big gap, and I think what's happened, I mean, I was looking at some figures earlier in the week about cash ISAs, for example. Obviously, we had extensive ISA coverage in this at the start of April. The take-up of ISAs is just, you know, has plummeted. People are getting more interested in cash ISAs, I'm talking about, not stocks and shares ISAs. People seem to be having a bit more of an appetite to be looking at investing, perhaps getting fed up with these sort of low rates of what they're getting. You can't draw much of a monthly income out of these sort of rates. It's very difficult. And especially with inflation biting. So
I was also wondering, going back to the Bitcoin, whether all the sort of talk in the media about it has perhaps, you know, probably too early to see it yet, but at least got people thinking about the idea of investing and getting involved in something a little bit more.
I reckon that there has been a kind of semi... I know exactly what you're trying to get at, Georgian. I wouldn't be surprised if people did take out some money out of things like ISAs and out of fixed rate bonds and had a little tentative punt in cryptocurrencies, or have looked at the longer term and actually gone, do you know what? Stock markets are performing pretty well at the moment. Perhaps we get involved in investing. And it's become an easier endeavour. I feel like the curtains have sort of been drawn, you know, have been opened up for when it comes to investing. People are a little bit more clued up on what it could mean. And I don't know, that's what my guidance says. I'll go back to the ISA example though. I mean, a lot of it also comes down to the fact that 95% of people now that haven't started a cash ISA probably, you know, don't get any benefits compared to if they just get a standard savings account because of the personal savings allowance. So unless you really are thinking in the long term and about it being tax-free in the future, a lot of smaller savers now just don't get into that sort of tax bracket anymore. So I don't know, it's an interesting time for savings. It really, I don't know where it goes from here. I thought that by now that we'd see especially easy access rates. I mean, they are really sort of awful. I mean, 1.31% is just is nothing. And what the fear is for this, and I know I've said this before and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it actually makes it very difficult for a first-time saver, someone that actually wants to get involved in saving risk-free, you know, without going through the rigmarole of investing and worrying about it could go up, could go down. Is that if you describe that to someone, let's say that's putting away £100 a month or whatever, and you say you're going to get 1.31% of the savings, and then they work out what that is, a lot of people just go, meh, what's the point?
But I think if you are a first-time saver, you've probably existed in this very low-rate environment your whole of your adult life. So actually, I wonder, though, if people do, who are first-time savers, really think too much about the difference in 0.5 or point, you know, whatever.
I don't think they think about the differences in that. I think what they do is that they go through like a calculator or whatnot, go, right, so I'm going to have saved, let's say, £500 over the course of the year by putting away whatever amount. And then they work out what return that's going to give them, and they go,
I think you are so optimistic, Lee. I absolutely don't, Georgia, think I've, anyone who's a first-time saver.
I've had lots of friends have asked me, you know, because when, like, you know, knowing this job role, people ask you for financial advice that are your friends. Where's the best savings account? What's it going to get me? And you describe it to them, and they go, No, I don't know about that. It happens all the time. I think you'd be surprised. People like to know what they're getting, is what I would say. But maybe I'm too optimistic.
Simon, your views on all this?
I do think that people do like to get some kind of return. I think there's a question people ask. They say, well, so if I do that, what am I going to get from it at the end of a year? And then you say, well, £5. And they're like, right, OK, I could achieve the same by just not buying a sandwich.
True.
So there is an issue there. So I think Lee's right, but I also think you are right, because the greatest benefit to a first-time saver comes not from any interest that they are going to earn, because they need to build up a savings pot to really make interest meaningful. Even if interest rates were at 10%, mm-hmm. they'd need to build up a big savings pot to make interest meaningful. It comes from the simple act of saving and putting away...
The confidence you get from seeing
putting
a
away
lump sum.
£100 a month and yeah. then looking at the end of the year and going, wow. I've got £1,200. Well done me. Mm-hmm. And I've said this before, the best savings account I ever had when I first started out saving was a Tesco internet savings account that had some kind of completely bonkers dual security thing on it that I could never get into the damn account. I set up a direct debit to it. By the time I managed to actually get into it, a couple of times I thought, oh, I might take some money out of that because I need some money. By the time I actually managed to get into it, I've managed to save about £1,600. And I thought, well, do you know what? I'm not going to spend that now.
Might keep going, yeah.
I might keep going. So
friction,
yeah,
it's a good thing sometimes.
It's the simple act of saving is the best thing you're going to get as a first-time saver. And then once you've actually built up that pot, then you can start earning some returns on it. The interesting thing about these interest rates from the challenger banks and the rates going up, and also the wider picture, is the end of this thing called the term funding scheme. The term funding scheme was introduced after the Brexit vote. It was part of the emergency measures that were brought in along with the interest rate cut to 0.25%. Basically, what it allowed banks to do is take almost interest-free loans from the Bank of England with the idea that they would then use that to pass through interest rate cuts. And the way they do that is not by taking money and then lending it out to the public, because banking isn't that simple. They take money onto their books, which then allows them to expand their balance sheets further. So in the way they expand their balance sheets further is, for example, if you want a mortgage and you tell them you want to borrow £200,000, they just hit a key on a keyboard and they create £200,000. That ended in March. No more money from that. And there was a suggestion that that would drive up mortgage rates. It hasn't, actually. Mortgage rates have remained relatively competitive. The point where banks start offering better savings rates, though, will come when people want to borrow more money, because at the moment they don't really need to offer better savings rates to the big banks, because they've got plenty of money on their books. They're not concerned about expanding their balance sheet a lot, because people just aren't really borrowing that much on mortgages. So ironically, in order to help savers, we need borrowers to go on another run and start borrowing lots more money. And I'm not sure that that's what we actually want. So
no, I don't think
we're still working through the poison of the financial crisis, I'm afraid.
We are indeed. In terms of saving, I do have to say, the best account I ever had was it was a terracotta pot. It was $9.99, so terrible returns on that one, because you're already down $9.99 and then you've got no rates or anything. But what it does, it just gave me the confidence at the end of the year. I put all of my change in. It was like £350. I bought myself a laptop, and it gave me the confidence then to start opening other accounts and start exploring. So to me, that's why I mention about the percentage points. I think when you become more engaged, and if people are asking you about the best accounts, Lee, they're already engaged. But for people who aren't, what I would say is don't necessarily get a terracotta pot. They're not cheap. But get some sort of piggy bank and just start. Just start. And as Simon says, you get the confidence to just carry on with that, and maybe you won't take that money out or smash the terracotta pot. Actually, I had to smash the terracotta pot because it was the £1 coin scenario. Oh.
There is a way of boosting boosting returns, though, for other people, not for yourself, unfortunately. But there's an idea that, for example, say you're a parent and your child has just started work and you want to encourage them to save a little bit every month. And your child says to you, all right, well, if I save £50 a month and at the end of the year I've got X, what's the interest I'm going to get on that? And you say, £6. But actually not £6, because you haven't had all that money in there for the whole year. It's probably going to be more like £2 or something like that. And they say, well, there's not really any point me bothering, because that's like not even a whole sandwich. You could try and do a similar trick to what the government does with tax relief on stuff and on help to buy and things like that. You say, all right, well, if you save £50 a month for 12 months, then at the end of it, I'll top it up by 10%.
Yeah.
That gives them an incentive to save. and gets them saving, and then at the end of it, they've learned that they can save some money and they've got a return. And maybe next year you just give them 5% and so on until they just start saving for the joyous benefit of saving itself. And the only winner here tonight is saving.
Oh, he's too good. He's too good. Right, finally, okay. It's been just a fortnight since changes were made to the MOT. As of May the 20th, the test has included three new fault categories, minor, major and dangerous. But we're hearing reports that already some garages have been ripping off car owners for repairs. Says who, Lee?
Sounds like it could be like a rock album, that, doesn't it? Minor, major and dangerous. Well, basically,
makes me wonder, what's the difference between major and dangerous? They both sound pretty they dangerous.
Do you know what?
I
literally just thought that major and dangerous. Yeah. I think dangerous is if you drove the car out, it might just like explode or something. You right. know, major's just, you know, not quite explodey level. No, what's happening here is so with these new categories, if a dangerous fault has to be rectified, so there has to be some repair work done on the car before it can be driven again. What's happening is that some garages are suggesting that the repairs have to be done on site before the car can be moved again. Mm. So they're kind of almost scaring drivers into saying, "No, this has got a you know, as soon as you say dangerous defects, people, you know, of course they're going to go, well, hold on a minute. Okay, well, that doesn't sound good." But then they're kind of held to ransom by the garage because the garage can basically, it might not be the cheapest place to get that fixed done. So you can't really shop around. They're making people feel like they can't take their car away and go and shop around and find somewhere that perhaps might be a cheaper place to get it done. And that's not on, because basically they don't have the power to do that. So you can take your car away. And there's just a bit of confusion, as there always is when sort of new rules like this come about. We've written quite a few stories about it. It's been quite well covered in the press, these changes. People kind of, I like to think, knew it was coming, but it doesn't stop garages from scaring people.
They may
people.
Not be ripping them off. It may just be the garages themselves don't. No.
Yeah, that's a very optimistic view to take, Georgie. I like that
Thanks.
A lot. I would have thought the garages have been filled in pretty comprehensively about these
you'd
changes.
Hope so, yeah,
you'd like to think so. And if this does happen to you, we'll definitely encourage you to get in touch with us so we can kind of investigate a little bit more what's going on. But, you know, all these changes come about and, you know, there's always a little bit of, you know, rubbish that happens at the beginning. And garages are a funny old place, aren't they, when you go in and, I don't know. When I take the car
see
in,
what I can
yeah,
do.
Yeah, no. Was
this
it
looks worse than I thought?
Was it actually a major issue, and you've just turned it into a dangerous one now that I'm worried, and you've kicked it in a bit that way? I'm being a bit disingenuous to go. But you know what I mean. It's kind of like sometimes it's good to find a good local garage that you trust and can take your vehicle into for many years, knowing that you know the prices, or you know that they're going to provide a good service. And you know, a lot of garages do that, and I'd be very surprised if there's many garages that are saying that don't know the rules and are forcing people to keep their car in.
Simon?
Well, yeah, as Lee said, if you're a car owner, finding a mechanic that you can trust is pretty important. It's up there on the top things that you can find, a mechanic, a plumber, things like that. So when something goes wrong, you need someone you can trust who's A, going to fix it properly, and B, going to charge you a fair price. And fair doesn't necessarily mean the cheapest. Mm-hmm. It means a fair price for doing the work. But the dangerous one means that you shouldn't really drive the car. So then the garage, you suck the old teeth.
Yeah.
Ooh,
scratch
that's
chin.
Gonna, ooh, I don't know. We're going to struggle to fit it in, but we could fit it in for you today, but it's going to be this much. And then you don't know how much the part costs. Mm-hmm. But what you need to say is, why is it costing me that much? How much is the part? How much is the labour? You can go online and a quick Google will tell you how many hours it should take to do any job on your car. The internet is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
You will also be able to find out what the cost of the part is. Now, if it's a main dealer and they're buying the part and it's a sort of genuine part, it's going to be more expensive than if you're just getting that part and it's a standard replacement part from Euro Car Parts, for example. So you need to take that into account. Take into account that labour can fluctuate a bit. The garage might like to err on the side of caution. But if they're quoting you 8 hours labour and it says 3 hours labour on the internet, you know something's wrong. If they're quoting you 4 and it says 3 on the internet, say, well, look, I looked this up and it says 3 hours. And if they say, well, we're quoting you 4 just to be on the safe side, say, well, if you do it in 3, will you charge me less? But the other thing you can do is you can phone another garage and say to them, how much will it cost for you to do this job? Phone around, leave your car, with the garage that's done the MOT and then say to the other garage, the thing is, it's got a dangerous fault on it, so I don't think that I should drive it. Would you be willing to come and collect it for me? And that other garage might be willing to come and collect it. Or I don't know exactly what the rules are, but that other garage might even be allowed to come around and drive the car from their garage.
And I reckon if you've got that far and you said it to the garage that you had the car at, they might even about reviewing perhaps their and how much they're charging you. Very good advice there. Thank you very much, Lee and Simon. You can stay up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.